This hour's top stories, Russia threatens to sever ties with the European Union if the bloc hits it with economic sanctions. Official figures show Britain's economy shrank by a record 9.9% last year due to the coronavirus pandemic. Also ahead, civil rights groups say a bill that the French government claims is aimed at tackling radical movements will stigmatize Muslims. Those were the top stories. Welcome. Russia says it is ready to sever ties with the European Union if the bloc hits it with economic sanctions.
We assume that we are ready to sever ties in case we see again, as we have felt more already, that sanctions create risks for our economy are imposed in most vulnerable areas. Yes, if you want peace, prepare for war.
Lavrov said Russia does not want to isolate itself from global life, but it has to be ready for possible sanctions. The Kremlin has echoed similar comments. It said Moscow needs to be ready to replace any of its vital infrastructure with elements it may be deprived of by sanctions. The EU reportedly plans to impose travel bans and asset freezes on allies of the Russian president. That'll be in response to the last week expulsion of German, Polish, and Swedish diplomats from Moscow. Russia said they had taken part in illegal protests against the detention of Kremlin critic Alexei Navalny. Now, the U.S. and Europe have accused Russia of blocking any solution to the conflict in eastern Ukraine. U.S. diplomat Rodney Hunter urged Russia to cease what he called its aggression in Ukraine. European members of the UN Security Council plus Germany leveled similar accusations. They said Russia is violating international law by using force against sovereignty of Ukraine. A Russian envoy to the UN rejected all those claims. He accused Ukraine of failing to implement the Minsk Peace Accord, with backing from French and German protectors. The accord was clinched in February 2015 to put an end to the conflict in eastern Ukraine. The war began in 2014 when fighters in the east sought independence from Ukraine. Geopolitical analyst Greg Simon says the U.S. is trying to halt the rise of Russia as a power in what he calls a new Cold War.
It's an attempt to try and block Russia from asserting what it wants to achieve in terms of its foreign and security policy through the use of deceptive discourse and representational force. This new Cold War is an attempt by the US using this words and images to affect the cognitive realm of different actors. So it's an attempt to maintain or hold on to their position of hegemony and prevent other powers from rising.
Ukraine is pressing the European Union to impose tougher sanctions on Russia over alleged human rights abuses. Some EU lawmakers, however, say the EU does not want to start a new Cold War with Russia. Jerome Hughes explains.
The seventh so-called Ukraine Association Council meeting has just taken place in Brussels. The delegation that travelled from Kiev used the opportunity to encourage the EU to ramp up its sanctions against Moscow.
We hope that the deep sanctions regime for violations of human rights would allow for the enhancement of the sanctions list and the expansion of the sanctions list of the European Union.
Russia denies claims it is trying to destabilize Ukraine and asserts its right to protect what it sees as legitimate regional interests. Just like several other nations surrounding Russia, the EU would like Ukraine to join its 27-nation bloc.
The European Union has already provided significant overall financial assistance to Ukraine. We are talking about 16 billion euros since 2014.
The EU regularly reminds us of its values, but critics say the bloc is often willing to look the other way in pursuit of its ambitions to further expand and to isolate Russia. After all, Ukraine is consistently ranked one of the most corrupt countries in the world.
The EU needs Russia. The European Commission's own website says two-thirds of the EU's oil imports come from Russia, as do three-quarters of its gas imports. A new pipeline from Russia to Germany, which is 90% complete, is set to double the EU's gas imports. We don't need a new Cold War, many argue.
As a Russian speaker living in the European Union, not me only, but 6 million we are all over, we want good relations, we don't want war.
Earlier this week, EU Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell attracted scathing criticism in the European Parliament.
High Representative Borrell, you should resign.
This was for going ahead with an official visit to Moscow last week. However, some legislators expressed an alternative view.
This isn't about human rights. This is a geopolitical agenda against Russia, fueled by a military-industrial complex who need an enemy to justify their millions.
If that is true, as citizens, most of us clearly underestimate the power of the arms industry. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Official data shows Britain's economy shrank by nearly 10% last year on the fallout from the pandemic. The Office for National Statistics said the fall marked the largest annual drop in gross domestic product on record. Its data shows that Britain's economy has remained 7.8% smaller than its pre-pandemic level. That comes despite two successive quarters of growth in the second half of 2020. Finance Minister Rishi Sunak has said the economy experienced a serious shock. He said the current lockdown continues to have a significant impact on many people and businesses. Much of the UK re-entered lockdown in early January to curb a new COVID variant that is more transmissible. Professor of Economics Steve Keane believes that government policies are to blame for the economic losses in the UK as they have failed to bring the pandemic under control.
The UK's performance is probably a case of the worst of both worlds. Driven largely by extremely bad government policy, which has been driven more by attempting to be popular with the populace rather than working out what is necessary to control a pandemic. Well, the main thing is to provide the finances people need. So you pay, you give people a cash flow that means they don't go bankrupt because they can no longer go to work. That's absolutely essential, particularly for low-paid workers in the UK. There are outrageous numbers of workers simply have no choice but to go to work because their pay is so bad in the first place. That's an absolute priority. But you've certainly got the most incompetent government in the world in the UK.
French lawmakers will next week hold a vote on an anti-Islam bill introduced by the government. Now, civil rights groups as well as academics and experts have warned that French Muslims will suffer under new rules. The French government introduced a bill last year to tackle what it called radical movements. Critics say the bill is part of a wider crackdown on civil liberties. They say the bill has a political rather than legal motive and is stigmatizing Muslims in France. The critics also say if the bill becomes law, it will legitimize the xenophobic arguments made by France's resurgent far-right groups. The lower house has already backed the bill. Last year, President Emmanuel Macron called Islam a religion in crisis. His anti-Islam stance has drawn widespread criticism from Muslim countries. French Justice Minister asks all prosecutors in France to condemn the BDS movement that calls for boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel. The European Court for Human Rights said last year that this boycott move or movement is legal. Who's right and who's wrong? A correspondent in Paris investigates.
These kind of actions calling for the boycott of Israeli products will not be possible anymore if the French Minister of Justice, Dupond-Moretti, succeeds in his intentions. In a letter, he instructed all prosecutors, magistrates and judges in France to condemn appeals to boycott Israeli products because it is a discrimination against the nation, he says. But an important group of French people reacted publicly, stating that BDS is legitimate and legal. In June last year, the European Court for Human Rights said that boycott is a legal political weapon. Pierre Stamboul is member of the board of the French Jewish Union for Peace and a BDS activist. His father was deported by the Nazis.
In France and in the USA, many Jews are involved in the BDS movement because Israel and the Zionist movement commit crimes against the Palestinians. The Israeli policy is an insult to our memory, our history, and our identity. Today, we see that France is again complicit with Israel. But nevertheless, France has been condemned by the European Court of Human Rights to pay 100,000 euros to BDS activists who organized the boycott action.
For lawyer Dominique Cochin, the judgment of the European Court prevails over the French directives.
C'est-à-dire que la France...
That means that France is committed to respect the judgments of the European Court of Human Rights. Minister Moretti pretends to obey this judgment. It says in Article 10 of the European Convention on Human Rights that the boycott is a totally legitimate political way of expression. But the French Minister of Justice, with this letter, tries again to criminalize the appeal to boycott.
The appeal to BDS has been launched by the Palestinians in 2005 and had a support all over the world, with remarkable events also in France, with actions in supermarkets or boat protests against the inauguration of a Ben Gurion square. They ask the end of the colonization and occupation of Palestine. The French Minister of Justice would like BDS activists to appear in courthouses like this to be condemned for criticizing Israel. That will not be easy because most lawsuits against BDS are won by the activists till now. Chris Denhant, Paris.
China has banned the broadcast of BBC World News, accusing it of giving fake and biased reports. A government statement said BBC's China-related report seriously violated broadcast guidelines and had harmed China's national interests. That comes a week after a British regulator banned the Chinese broadcaster CGTN over license problems. The ban has provoked UK's condemnation, with the country's Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab calling the move an unacceptable curtailing of media freedom. Beijing and London are at odds over several issues, including Britain's ban on Chinese telecom group Huawei and the situation in Hong Kong. Political commentator Fabrizio Goldoni says the BBC's position and way of reporting has seriously violated China's media regulations.
What the authority has said, that the BBC seriously violated the China media regulation after they several reports, actually, but in particular at the early of February, with allegation, detailing allegation of torture against Uyghurs in Xinjiang. I do not agree with the BBC position and the way of reporting. The same as I do not agree when BBC was reporting the facts of Hong Kong, where I live. There are several area of friction. One you mentioned, that is Xinjiang. Then we have the South China Sea, and we have a Taiwan issue, and we have Hong Kong. And now, luckily, after the national law has become much more quiet, and has been, in my opinion, solved.
The South Korean government has announced that it will begin COVID-19 vaccinations for its people later on this month. This comes as the country is struggling with a growing number of daily coronavirus infections, Frank Smith reports.
South Korea Thursday announced the most daily new COVID-19 cases in 2 weeks, as more than 500 people were found to have contracted the virus. South Korea now has about 80,000 cases and 1,500 deaths from COVID-19. The government plans to begin vaccinations for its 52 million people later this month.
The government plans to operate 250 vaccination centers. When all of 250 centers open, we run 250 modules, then 150,000 people can get vaccinated per day. This means that 4.5 million people can get vaccinated each month.
Meanwhile, Thursday, many South Koreans traveled back to their hometowns for the Lunar New Year holiday.
South Korea has tried to strike a balance between containing the spread of the virus and social and economic sacrifice. Cafes and restaurants have pretty much stayed open while restricting hours and seating capacity. And wearing a mask in public or while taking mass transportation is quite strictly enforced.
Most public places have temperature checking sensors. For private businesses, people are required to sign in on paper or digitally. Still, most were glad to travel, albeit carefully.
Last year, I couldn't go to my hometown for the Lunar New Year or Thanksgiving. I was sad I couldn't meet my family or parents very often, so I'm finally going this year.
The vaccine will be welcome, as many businesses have closed and unemployment spiked.
The fact that it will take some time for everyone to get the vaccine and for the COVID-19 situation to die down is a bit difficult to deal with and unfortunate. But I was very happy to hear that we will be able to get vaccinated this year.
Although people generally follow the rules, new variants have been discovered in the country, and health officials warn levels may again increase, prompting stricter measures. Frank Smith, Seoul.
As part of the battle against the coronavirus pandemic, Venezuela has bought 10 million Russian vaccines known as Sputnik V. Despite facing U.S. accusations, Venezuela is continuing its battle against the deadly virus with the aid of allies. Jesus Silva is in Caracas.
President Nicolas Maduro has announced that Sputnik V vaccines are on their way to Venezuela this week in order to shore up the country's ongoing fight against the coronavirus outbreak. Within the framework of a bilateral agreement between Venezuela and Russia, Maduro has signed a contract with Russia to purchase 10 million doses of Sputnik V COVID-19 vaccines. The Venezuelan head of state has thanked Russian President Vladimir Putin for providing the medical resources to tackle the virus outbreak. Furthermore, Maduro has stressed that his administration will ensure that every person in the country will be vaccinated. In this light, Venezuelan officials have praised the alliance between Caracas and Moscow.
Although U.S. sanctions impede Venezuela's purchase of vaccines from abroad, Russia has bravely disregarded such sanctions and sold them to our nation.
But some opposition figures have criticized the bilateral deal.
Maduro's relation with Putin is not seen positively by the U.S., so he's deliberately stirring conflict with Washington.
Nonetheless, legal experts have a totally different view.
Esta situación.
Maduro and Putin are correctly saving lives with the vaccines. For them, health is more important than U.S. foreign policy.
Despite the economic difficulties prompted by the U.S. blockade, the Venezuelan government has made great financial efforts to purchase millions of Russian vaccines in hopes of containing the ongoing COVID outbreak that has rocked the whole Latin American region. Jesus Silva, Caracas.
And that's it with international news.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghodde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on February 18, 2019 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, during a meeting with the people of East Azerbaijan. The meeting was held at Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya in commemoration of the anniversary of Tabriz Uprising of February 18, 1978.
First of all,
Before the revolution, the government which was ruling over our country was deeply opposed to Islam. They were not very strict about Islamic appearances, but they were after destroying the roots and the essence of Islamic faith of the people. In this regard, I have many examples, proofs, and memories in mind, but there is not enough time to mention them. The revolution turned around the system of government and made Islam the pivot of managing the country. The revolution made Islam the pivot of management. Islamic rules are the criteria for rejecting or accepting the laws of the country and the standard for judging the performance of the executive officials of the country. The country was politically dependent before the revolution. That is to say, the government, both Muhammad Reza Shah and different governmental organizations, obeyed America.
Allah, Allah, la ilaha illallah.
They were just waiting for America to make a move. Again, there is overwhelming evidence in this regard. Dr. Amini traveled from Iran to America in order to convince the Americans to let him be the Prime Minister of Iran. When he came back, he became Prime Minister. After a couple of years, the Shah, who was opposed to Dr. Amini, made a trip to America and convinced the Americans to remove him. The Shah came back and removed him. This was the situation of our country. In order to install a prime minister, the Shah, who was the head of the country, needed the agreement and approval of America. In the case of many issues, the Shah used to invite the American and English ambassadors to his palace in order to discuss his decision with them. If they did not agree, the decision was not implemented. This is what political dependence means. They obeyed America. And before America, they obeyed England. It was the English who brought Reza Khan to power. When they realized that he was no longer useful to them, they fired him. They forced him out of the country and put his son in power. This was our situation before the revolution.
Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to
Ministry.
Forty-two years have passed since the people of Iran took to the streets and brought about the Islamic Revolution of 1979 under the leadership of Ayatollah Imam Ruhollah Khomeini. Today, it is a proven fact that the 1979 Islamic Revolution created great hope among the deprived nations throughout the world. What were the main factors which led to the Islamic Revolution, you may ask? A society torn between tradition and Western modernity, poverty and prosperity, dictatorship, and a yearning for democracy. The reasons are countless, but to answer the question in full, one should not look at the 1979 Revolution as an isolated incident. Rather, it was the culmination of over a century's strive to end the dictatorial powers of monarchs, remove foreign influences from Iranian politics, distribute wealth while ensuring both economic prosperity and allow for central guidance and control, and to create a constitution that was both democratic and would not alienate the traditional and religious portion of the population. The world was surprised and astonished by the Iranian Revolution, which was led by Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini in exile from Paris. The personality of Iran's Ayatollah Khomeini was a critical element in redefining Iran's role in the region. Imam Khomeini's background, charisma, and thirst for revolting for the people of Iran influenced the atmosphere leading to the revolution. One can understand Khomeini's personality and beliefs by examining his background. His devotion to Islam, reflected by his simplistic, austere lifestyle focused on spiritual matters, attracted the majority of Iranian society, which was stricken with poverty. Many of these traditional citizens flocked to the modern cities seeking opportunity, only to wind up crowded into slums. Imam Khomeini's life of suffering and finally return to Iran replicated a legacy of the oppressed experience. Imam Khomeini unwaveringly opposed monarchy, arguing that only rule by a leading Islamic jurist would ensure that the true Islamic ruling was properly followed. Imam Khomeini's novel artistry was seen in the way that he took the corrupted system that had been ruling the country and replaced it with a political system of service to the people rather than ignoring them. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Mara Osman. The story of the Iranian Revolution is not similar to the story of other revolutions in the 20th century, as the wave of Islamic revolution swept away the Shah's corrupt regime and brought a new political discourse which cannot be categorized either as a communist or a capitalist. It was and always will be an Islamic revolution. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Mr. Muhammad Abed, political commentator. Thank you for being with us, Muhammad. Now, just how major was the impact of the revolution that saw the ouster of Iran's king of that time, Shah Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, and the beginning of the era of Ayatollah Sayyid Ruhollah Khomeini as the supreme leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran?
Well, first of all, you have to take a look at the whole region in general, and you will understand all these changes that took place throughout these 40 years. At that time, you had the major conflict, which is still here up till now, which is the Arab-Israeli conflict. At a time when Israel was the so-called invincible army, at a time when they used to launch the Israeli occupation, used to launch any aggression whenever they wanted at any Arab country. They reached up till Tunisia and other faraway countries like Sudan. Now we see that Israel, the occupation entity, right now is a besieged entity that is surrounded by rockets and missiles that are really spreading fear among the Zionist settlers. And all this is due to the policy which was adopted by the Islamic Revolution in Iran. I mean, the creation of a strategy of patience that took the long run into consideration, not rather very easily achieved the victories, but rather ones that took some time in order to be achieved. And I mean, this brought a shift and a major upside down, if you will, change in the strategic equation in the region. You saw the aggressor, now we see the aggressor, which used to take freedom in launching any aggression wherever they wanted, are now besieged even by the Gaza Strip. They cannot even launch an aggression on Gaza without taking thousands of calculations into consideration. So this is one of the major shifts that I see deemed that are very important and are the outcome of the Islamic Revolution and the Islamic Republic.
Well, four decades later after the revolution, in what aspect is this Islamic Revolution in Iran still mostly visible while the country still suffers from the fiercest economic and political sanctions that has ever hit a sovereign nation?
Well, also to take a logical course in this domain, look, in spite of all these economic sanctions and all this blockade against the Islamic Republic, you see that it is the major strategic power in the region, whereas other countries such as Saudi Arabia, such as other the United Arab Emirates and others are not taken into consideration when it comes to the major players in the region and at the international level. You do not see, for instance, the United States minding the whatever the Saudis are saying, whereas you see every move and every act taken by the Islamic Republic of Iran is minded and is taken into analysis and so in the whole region. So this is one example. I know because of the shortage of time, we cannot discuss this very in a very long way, but this serves as a good example that in spite of all these sanctions, in spite of all that sort of punishment that mm-hmm. was being targeted the Islamic Republic, due to its political stances and due to its support to the oppressed throughout the region, mainly those related to the Arab-Israeli conflict, you see that Israel is that the Islamic Republic is being punished for that. But still, one major lesson that can be learned to all the revolutions that are to come throughout history is that the Iranians have been supreme teachers in teaching the world how to turn a challenge into an opportunity. They have used these sanctions in order to develop their industries, to develop ways of
this is what I want to discuss further, because what you said is it falls on the on the shoulders of merchants, on traders, intellectuals, urban masses who played a grave role in the success of the Islamic Revolution led by Ayatollah Sayyid Ruhollah Khomeini. These categories of citizens have suffered the most under this current wave of sanctions and the sanctions that have been there for the past 40 years, because the West believes that for a regime change to work in Iraq, in Iran, they have to target these specific categories and suffocate them as much as possible. How do you think this plan have worked so far?
Well, this is not new to the arrogant powers. Whenever they cannot achieve any triumph while dealing with the major opponents, I mean the government of Iran or the leadership in Iran, they turn to the weaker side. They try to target the as you said, the merchants, the ordinary people in the street. We have seen this also in Lebanon. Now, mm-hmm. when they cannot achieve any victories against the Islamic resistance, they turn to suffocating at the economic level all the Lebanese people in order to turn into a phase when the whole Lebanese people, and hopefully, and I'm sure this, inshallah, will never happen, that the whole Lebanese people would turn to the accusation to the Islamic resistance that you are the reason why we are falling this. Now, the Iranians, and in a very clever step in this regard, have always focused on insight, on the well awareness of the whole factors and elements of the conflict. It has become clear that to all the people in Iran and Lebanon, all over the region, that if you give up to the demands of the oppressors, to the arrogant powers, the United States basically, you will have to pay a larger price than the one you are paying when you are steadfast and you are standing up against those challenges. So that's why this sort of answers the question that mm-hmm. those merchants, one way or another, know that if the Americans come to control the region, to control Iran, they are going to absorb and use all their resources of the country, and this the merchants will and all the Iranian citizens will be paying the price to that. So the creation of this insight among the people of the Islamic Republic has been also fruitful and has been successful in this regard.
Well, we have less than 2 minutes. I want to ask you about the continued development and actually the impressive industrial progress in Iran, despite the sanctions. But it is conveying a message to the world that Iran will never stop its development and its prosperity while simultaneously resisting the U.S. vicious plots in the region. But in that regard, a lot has been said about Iran's nuclear program. How do you think Iran will maneuver around this that's supposedly a very large red flag by the West?
Yes, they have been doing this successfully for over 20 years now. They have been dealing with the threats. They have been dealing with the any good or signs of rapprochement, if you will, from mm-hmm. the other from the Western world with similar steps. So there is no fear on this. But once again, I have to repeat this issue of the creation of the human being that is willing to stand up against mm-hmm. any challenge in order to develop at the nuclear level, at the other levels of industrial and a few weeks ago, I think a new car was manufactured in Iran, a new model. So you see the sanctions have not been able to achieve their goal of creating despair in the people of Iran.
Well, we still have to see how this supposed rapprochement, if it will happen and how it will happen. I want to thank you very much, Mohammed Abed, political commentator, for joining us from Beirut to talk about the effect of the Islamic revolution inside of Iran. Thank you for being with us. Please stay tuned. We will continue this matter about how the revolution affected the region after the break.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
The victory of the Islamic Revolution in Iran revived high hopes in the region of West Asia, especially for the Palestinian people and the Lebanese people who suffered from the existence of Israel, specifically that Imam Khomeini's position from Israel was clear from the very beginning. The Islamic Revolution became the main force facing the Zionist project in the region and the main backer of the Palestinian liberation movements while helping create a regional power of allied resistance forces. From a revolution to a regional force in this following report.
Israel invaded Beirut in 1982 and drove the Palestinian resistance fighters out of Lebanon. There was fear of a coming horror and new alienation. Almost everything would have fallen apart had it not been for a few heroes who kept their fingers on the trigger in the face of what was defined as absolute evil. For so long, the Israeli entity thought that in its war on Lebanon, it would push its last opponents to surrender, which paves the way for scripting a new history for the region. However, its endeavor was faltered by a group of few men back then with a strength which came solely from faith that was later sponsored by a man who believed that the main confrontation with powers ruining the region could not take place until after the fall of the Shah of Iran, and as he said, happened. The Islamic Republic of Iran translated the words of its leader into action, sponsoring the first resistance force in Lebanon and later in Palestine with training, weapons, and funding until the victory of Lebanon was achieved and liberation was attained. Lebanon's victory was a good news for all oppressed countries, organizations, and individuals as it increased steadfastness and determination in the path of what one aspires to in terms of glory and elevation, the realization of independence, freedom, and the establishment of justice. From Baghdad to Damascus, Beirut, Gaza, and Sana'a, passing through the oppressed nations of Bahrain and Hejaz, this yearn for social justice and liberation and the formation of an allied force of resistance across the region of West Asia would not have been possible without the support of those who believed in standing with the vulnerable in the face of the arrogant. It is what the essence of the revolution of Imam Ruhullah al-Khomeini was all about. The Islamic Revolution of 1979, which brought about the emergence of the Islamic Republic of Iran, became the awakening of the peoples of our region and beyond. The Islamic Republic of Iran's model of confrontation with imperialism has challenged the U.S. and its puppet Israeli regime in the region and across the entire world to such a degree that Iran's strategic influence in the form of an allied forces of resistance has become the U.S. and the Zionist regime's biggest concern.
To discuss this issue with us from London is Shabir Hassan Ali, political commentator. Thank you for being with us. Shabir, now, since its inception, the Islamic Republic of Iran has challenged the world's corrupt political system and created new political spaces that enabled the oppressed, for example, the oppressed Palestinians, to resist the American imperialism and the Zionist occupation. This has been a very long and bumpy ride in the region. How far will this be going with the current wave of regional normalization with the Israeli entity?
I think, first of all, the normalization will not make any difference. The normalization has always really been there. It's not something new. It's now just formalized. The resistance factions on the ground are alien to the occupiers that occupy them. For example, if you look at the countries of so-called UAE or so-called Saudi or so-called Bahrain, these countries are not ruled by their own people. They're ruled by imports, people who have no connection to the actual land and are purely working for the Zionists, the same way that Palestine is occupied by European Zionists. This is the same game. So in reality, the normalization, I don't think, will make any real difference. What it will do is it will make things a lot clearer in many ways. And it will hasten the demise of these entities like so-called Saudi Arabia, so-called Bahrain, so-called UAE, and all of these, as well as, of course, the parent of them, which is the Zionist entity occupying Palestine. And I think the important thing that we need to understand is what Iran is doing is not something particularly strange or particularly problematic. From a global perspective, it shouldn't be seen in this way. Because if you look at all of the global countries, people have alliances. This is something that's been there from like history, from ancient history. Mm-hmm. People from different countries, they make alliances, and they work together to try and better their lot. Now, if the countries that are making alliances are occupied by third parties who have no space there, then at the end of the day, a responsible country like Iran will make an alliance with the actual people on the ground, which is really what the country is. The country is not made up of these one or two families. It's made up of the actual people on the ground.
This is actually what scares the Western regime, because they extensively condemned the regional coordination that the Islamic Republic of Iran was able to achieve along with the allied forces of the resistance in all of West Asia, to a point that once surrounded Iran has now allies that have encircled the presence of the colonialists, the presence of the occupiers in the region. This led to a maximum campaign, pressure campaign of sanctions for everyone, including the allied forces of the resistance, not only for the Islamic Republic of Iran. How much do you think this will damage the performance of the regional allied forces of the resistance in West Asia?
I think if we look at the policy of sanctions, maximum pressure or otherwise, it's actually more damaging to the party making the sanctions. In the case of Iran and the resistance axis, the sanctions have been more damaging to America and to the West because they have lost a very, very important market for which they can do trade. As for Iran and the resistance axis, yes, of course, there is a short-term pain. But ultimately, it forces people to be reliant on themselves. And like Khamenei has said, and even Sayyid Hassan has said, we need to start relying on ourselves. We need to stop relying on the outside. And at the end of the day, the allies that the resistance axis has got, such as China, such as Russia, These are the powerhouses of trade in the world, like China. Everything is made in China. You know, from the most amazing things that America claims are its own, nothing is actually made in America. America is useless in terms of manufacture. Mm-hmm. Everything is made in China, and China is friends with the resistance axis. So even though these sanctions with the extraterritorial components and all of this talk of maximum pressure and all of this, really, this is only valid from a PR perspective. In reality, while there is pain for the people on the ground, I'll not say there isn't pain, mm-hmm. what it will do is when you push a person hard, ultimately what will happen is that person will say, well, okay, fine, there's no point me trying to negotiate with you because you're just not interested. Mm-hmm. I will go and make this myself, or I will deal with people who will deal with me.
Well, this is exactly what happened in the region, because we saw the emergence of Hezbollah in Lebanon to face the Israeli aggression. We saw the moral boost that was provided to the popular mobilization units in Iraq by the Islamic Republic, and the regional Cold War against both Saudi Arabia, to be honest with you, and also the Israeli regime. We had lending an Islamic flavor to the anti-imperialist sentiment in West Asia as a whole, and even openly challenging Western foreign policy by giving aid to Latin American countries, for example, like Venezuela. How can one explain this smooth flow of inspiration from the Islamic Revolution to cultures that are not even Islamic?
I think what we have to understand about the Islamic Revolution is while it was Islamic, it was actually a global revolution of the oppressed against the oppressor. And Imam Khomeini mentioned this many times in many of his speeches, that anyone who sees themselves oppressed at the hand of the empire, at the hand of the powers of global arrogance or Zionism, they will all come together. Because, for example, if you take Venezuela, Venezuela has been hammered really badly. Cuba, even, has been hammered very badly by America just for wanting to be different, just for daring to be, to follow a different political ideology, and to not allow the infection of American capitalism and its various tentacles, if you like.
Simply for wanting to be sovereign nations.
Exactly. They want their sovereignty. And America doesn't want people to be sovereign. America wants people to be beholden to the empire. And when other countries see someone who is like a standard bearer, a flag bearer, for this movement of anti-imperialism, anti-arrogance, they all sort of come together, because good people generally come together. We may have differences in terms of our religious beliefs and all of this, but in terms of the ideology against imperialism, mm-hmm. and against oppression, everyone is on the same page. And that also lets people discuss later on religious ideas and find commonalities in all of this.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have less than 2 minutes, but I want to discuss what the Biden administration might bring forward to the table in the region of West Asia, because they are sending sort of vague messages. They want to wrap Rushmore, but at the same time, they are increasing their military maneuvers in both Iraq and Syria. They're even again, backing ISIS and Daesh and Al-Qaeda in Syria and in Iraq. They're targeting popular mobilization unit bases as well. It is obvious that also the current leader of the revolution, Imam Sayyid Ali Khamenei, is suspicious of the American intentions. Do you think the region is moving towards negotiations or just a huge explosion?
I don't think there's going to be any negotiations. America has clearly said that they're not willing to reduce any of their sanctions or do anything from their side in order to encourage Iran to, you know, have any as a show of good faith. I think ultimately what they will do is just like what Obama did. They will manufacture and they will feed things like Daesh with a means to try and break the region further and cause more problems. But I think this time, the damage that will be done to the empire will be very serious. Mm-hmm. And it will end up leaving and taking its lapdogs like the Saudis and the Israelis out of the region. It won't be easy, but I think that, as they say, you can see the light at the end of the tunnel.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to thank you very much, Shabir Hassan Ali, political commentator, for joining us from London to talk about how the Islamic Revolution led by Imam Ruhollah Khomeini affected the entire world, not only West Asia. Thank you for being with us. And thank you. Please stay tuned next week for more from the Middle East Stream.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Muhammad is my guide, Muhammad is my teacher, Muhammad my beloved Rasulullah.
I want to be like you.
Like you.
In everything I do, Ya Rasulullah.
I want to walk like you, talk like you, read my Quran just like you.
And we have not sent you, but as a mercy to the world.
I want to be a servant of God like Muhammad.
Be like Muhammad, live like Muhammad, see like Muhammad did. Muhammad, Rasulullah.
A'udhu billahi min shaitanir rajim, bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Dear brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to Like Muhammad. I am Javed Akbari, and we are going to talk about Allama Tabatabai's Sunan al-Nabi. This is, of course, a book written by Allama Tabatabai, who is one of the great scholars. And Sunan al-Nabi is about the narrations of the Prophet and conducts and customs of the noble Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and his family. The Quran is the book of guidance. ذَلِكَ الْكِتَابُ لَا رَيْبَ فِيهِ هُدًى لِلْمُتَّقِينَ. In the religion of Islam, most of the actions and deeds, especially the acts of worship, are accompanied by some etiquette and special manners. It is reported from Zayd ibn Ali from Abi Ja'far, alayhi salatu wasalam. Abu Ja'far is Imam Baqir alayhi salatu wasalam, because he is father of Imam Ja'far as-Sadiq alayhi salatu wasalam. He says that the Holy Prophet, when he recited the Holy Quran, he recited with the best voice from all the people. This is one of the reports from Imam Ja'far as-Sadiq alayhi salatu wasalam. It's not a saying from the Holy Prophet, but it shows the adab and the manner of reciting the Holy Quran. Now, this saying from Imam Muhammad Baqir alayhi salatu wasalam indicates that we must recite the Holy Quran as beautifully as possible. And that was why the art of tajweed, reciting the Holy Quran, came into being with the passage of time. Okay, tajweed was a skill that was developed by and by and with the passage of time in the history ever since the early period of Islam. Tajweed means to recite the Holy Quran in the best possible voice. It is important and recommended to recite the Quran as beautifully as possible. But of course, one should use his best effort, and he should make his best attempt to recite the Quran with the best voice. But if someone cannot do it, he can recite it in any manner possible. Okay? There is tremendous reward in reciting the Holy Quran with the best voice. It has an impact on the listener also. If someone listens to a beautiful recitation, he gets attracted to the Holy Quran. He gets actually enchanted by the beautiful recitation of the Holy Quran. There is also another narration from Rawandi. Rawandi actually reports this narration in Ad-Da'wah. This report is recorded in Ad-Da'wah, written by Rawandi. The report is from the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, who said, Jibreel told me to recite the Quran while standing. There is no problem whatsoever when it comes to sitting and reciting the Holy Quran. And of course, there is no problem in reciting the Holy Quran while standing. But whichever is more respectful, you have to follow that. You can recite the Holy Quran whether sitting or standing. But what is actually more important and what is more significant is to handle the Quran with more respect. And then there's also another report in Majma'ul Bayan from Anas. Anas Ibn Malik. Of course, Anas was one of the servants of the Holy Prophet. He used to work in the Prophet's house. This report is recorded in Majma'ul Bayan. Okay, Anas says that he would draw out, the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, would draw out his voice while reciting the Holy Quran. Okay. Now, drawing out one's voice means that looking at the Prophet himself actually prolonged his voice. Prolonging is not only for the sake of prolonging, but prolonging is for the sake of making one's voice more beautiful, more attractive. There is more emphasis, and it further attracts the reader's attention.
You are my one. Taught me to never judge. Now all I want is to be with you.
Allahumma salli ala Sayyidina Mustafa ala Habibika Nabika Mustafa. Allahumma salli ala Sayyidina
In modern time, when we listen to the reciters, those who recite the Holy Quran, of course, those professional reciters of the Holy Quran, and when they recite, the tajweed is actually about drawing out one's voice and making it beautiful and making it attractive. So those who do tajweed of the Holy Quran, they draw out their voice. They do not recite the verses or the words of the Holy Quran quickly, one after another, because that's not the goal. It's not important to finish reciting one chapter of the Holy Quran quickly in a matter of few minutes or seconds. Yes, that's not the goal. Reciting the Holy Quran in a manner which is beautiful, which is attractive, is very, very important. And there's also another report in Al-Kafi. Al-Kafi is one of the most important Shi'a books written by Kulayni, of course. This report is from Abdullah ibn Farqad and Al-Mu'alla ibn Al-Khunais from Imam Sadiq alayhi salatu wasalam, who said, "As for us, we recite according to the recitation of Ubay." Okay, as for us, meaning that the Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salatu wasalam recited the Quran according to the recitation of Ubay. Perhaps those people, those of you who have very little information, I should tell you that there are different recitations. There are seven recitations, okay? One of the recitations is the recitation of Ubay. And there are other recitations also. And it is permissible to recite the Quran according to the recitation of each of those reciters, each of those seven individuals. But according to Imam Sadiq alayhi salatu wasalam, he says that we recite the Quran according to the recitation of Ubay. This is one of the reciters, and he has his own method of reciting the Quran. Of course, there are, as I said, there are seven other recitations, and this is mentioned in Al-Khisal. You can refer to the book Al-Khisal for yourself to see the names and to find the names of other reciters. And then we have another report in Al-Majma'ul Bayan, one of the Shi'a books, and it's a very important book, of course. And it is a book in commentary or in tafsir of the Holy Quran. When it comes to the commentary of Surah At-Tin from Muqatil, there is a report from Qatada, who said that when the Holy Prophet completed the Surah At-Tin, he would say, "Yes, indeed, and I am witnesses to this." Yes, "I am witnesses to this" means وَنَحْنُ عَلَى ذَلِكَ مِنَ الشَّاهِدِينَ وَالشَّاكِرِينَ وَنَحْنُ عَلَى ذَلِكَ مِنَ الشَّاهِدِينَ.
it is very much recommended that when you recite any surah of the Quran, any surah of the Holy Quran, and when you finish reciting a few verses of the Quran, it is recommended to say Sadaqallahu al-Aliyyu al-Azim wa Sadaqa Rasuluhu al-Nabi al-Kareem wa nahnu ala dhalika min ash-shahidin wa ash-shakirin. Now, according to the report, Qatada said that whenever the Prophet recited this